Today on Maine Calling, endangered species in Maine. The third Friday in Maine, today, is Endangered Species Day. It is designed to call attention to threatened and endangered wildlife around the world and in your own community. In Maine, currently about 24 inland fish and wildlife species are listed as endangered, and even more are listed as threatened. The majority are birds, but there are also butterflies, mammals, fish, and a snail. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about these species and find out what's being done to help them. We'll also discuss proposed changes to the Federal Endangered Species Act, which has been in place for more than 50 years. And we'll touch on some endangered plants as well as animals. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today is Endangered Species Day. We'll discuss some of Maine's most vulnerable wildlife, proposed federal changes to the endangered species list process, and we will learn about successful conservation projects. Joining me for the hour, Laura Minnick-Zitsky, who is wildlife ecologist and associate director of conservation with Maine Audubon, and Dr. Alexander Fish, wildlife research biologist, population ecologist, and ornithologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. We invite you to share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining us today on Endangered Species Day. Why don't I just start, Laura, by asking you, when someone says an endangered species, what do they mean exactly? How dire is it for that species?
Well, technically, an endangered species is a species that will likely go extinct if we don't do something to help them. That's generally how I frame it.
All right. And Alex, how do you determine that?
Yeah, I think Laura is exactly right. I mean, it's tough, right? So when in Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, when we're thinking about that, we kind of have this rigorous process where we assess a species, its population, threats, and risks, and really try to determine, you know, would it fit as endangered or maybe some other type of at-risk category. But for every species, if we think about what could be listed as endangered, there's such a huge diversity of species, from turtles to bumblebees to butterflies to Canada lynx. So there's not really a one size fits all approach. We really have to try to get into the mind of that species and evaluate it at that scale.
Get into the mind of that species, whether it's a snail or a turtle or a bird, right?
Some are easier than others, for sure.
Well, let me ask you, Alex. I mean, Maine is vast, especially the North Woods. Is it a challenge sometimes to know for sure?
Yeah, I think that is, you know, lack of knowledge or information is a threat for quite a number of species, especially when we get into that invertebrate or insect realm where, you know, we're not combing the woods throughout northern Maine. So we really have to rely on information coming from a lot of different spheres. Of course, our own agency work. But increasingly, we're relying on kind of participatory or community scientists to help us out, because there's platforms like iNaturalist or eBird where people are observing species and then they're basically marking on a map where they're finding those. So we're able to use that information, which then informs, you know, where the species is and what might those risks of extirpation or extinction be.
Yeah. And Laura, I'm thinking that some citizen science projects may actually help some animals fall off of an endangered or threatened species list. Has that happened, or do you believe it could happen?
That's an interesting question. I think community science has, can do a variety of things. I think not only potentially detecting species like Alex was talking about, but also just engaging people, I think, in some of our more vulnerable species. And a species that is very near and dear to my heart, that's an endangered species that I'm sure bring up a lot, is the piping plover, which nests here in southern Maine. And I would say our volunteer network, even though I don't think it's that the network is necessarily sufficient to help delist piping plovers, but they are a really essential part of our success so and getting the work done in terms of, you know, spreading the word about these birds and sharing with the public what we can do to help make sure that both people and plovers can share the beach safely. I mean, we wouldn't be where we are without community science and extensive volunteer networks.
Well, let's ask about the piping plover, because there's been a lot of good news about that bird lately. Is that possibly going to move from the endangered to threatened species list anytime soon?
Well, at the state level, so we have both a state endangered species list and a federal endangered species list. And piping plovers are listed as endangered in the state of Maine. And that is a different process than the federal, which is where it is listed as a threatened species at the federal level. So, that our work in Maine might influence something on the Maine endangered species list, but looking at the federal level, New England has been recently doing very well in terms of piping plover success. However, our colleagues in Canada, the Mid-Atlantic, and the South are seeing some real challenges in terms of piping plover numbers on their beaches. So at the federal level, looking at the big picture, even though we are having great success in Maine and Massachusetts and other parts of New England and other areas, the birds still need a lot of help.
Speaking of success stories, Alex, the biggest one, perhaps, or at least the most charismatic, of course, is the bald eagle, right?
Yeah, bald eagle recovery was listed at both the state level, delisted the federal level, delisted as well, is kind of, yeah, one of those charismatic species everyone sees. Recovery has happened. And I think it's, you know, something that sometimes we take for granted, especially those of us who weren't outside as frequently when bald eagles were almost impossible to find.
And those of you who are young. Okay, go on. Yeah. Go on.
But I think even down east Maine played a really important role, because that was kind of a hub and a hotspot and a stronghold for the species. So I think that's something that folks should feel pretty proud of.
Oh, tell me more about that, the role of down east Maine. I think a lot of people believe that the bald eagle kind of just came back after DDT was banned.
Yep, so that was definitely part of it. But really, the department was pretty involved with finding eagle nests and then working with private landowners to really implement some volunteer strategies to try to protect or limit disturbance around those nesting sites. And then by protecting the nesting sites, you know, eagles, of course, had better reproductive success, were producing more juveniles that then started to recolonize the rest of Maine and successfully nest.
All right. Well, anybody who's watched the recent season of Borealis on Maine Public Television has learned about the New England cottontail. Laura, have you been involved in projects to try to bring the New England cottontail back to bigger numbers?
Not necessarily. Alex and colleagues at IFNW, also some colleagues at Rachel Carson National Wildlife Refuge, have been more involved. So I'll let Alex talk.
Alex, tell us about the cottontail and how bad it's been and where we are today.
Yeah, so cottontails were one of these species we're really proud of in the department, because initially these were petitioned to be listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, but it was because of the work in states like Maine, as well as in southern New England, that actually the Fish and Wildlife Service said, you're doing such great work, we don't need to list this species. And so we've been working in the state, or at least one of my coworkers has, to build back, build more populations along the southern Maine coast, try to do some more habitat management. But one of the really cool aspects of this species is we actually work with a captive rearing facility where they actually have bunnies in captivity, and they do these really interesting things like bunny speed dating, where they put cages next to each other. And then based by which rabbits are spending the most time together, they, of course, put them into the pen to hopefully raise lots of little bunnies that then we can release back into the wild. And so we've been watching and seeing the population grow in Maine, which is pretty exciting.
I'm looking at the state list right now. And Laura, I see that really most of the animals that are listed either on the endangered species list, Maine's endangered species list, or Maine's threatened species list are birds. And we have talked a lot on Maine Calling about the declining population of birds, the declining population of insects. Which of the birds on this list are you most concerned about?
Oh, that's like asking who my favorite child is. that's a tough question. I guess, and as a biologist, I'd often group them. And I have my personal bias, of course, with like shorebirds and seabirds. Our shorebirds, we've lost really over a third of our shorebirds, migratory shorebirds, over the last 40 years, and that's always a concern. But another suite of species that I think that I worry about, and thankfully colleagues at IFNW are doing some really innovative work on, are things like our aerial insectivores, which sounds like a strange term, but these are birds that are eating our insects that are on the wing. So things like swallows and swifts, these are a whole suite of species that I think are really both beautiful and helpful and fun to watch, but we're seeing some serious decline, some of them nest in colonies that are hard to kind of monitor and manage and haven't been doing as faring as well. So that's a suite of species that I guess I think about, and I'm grateful for the folks that are working to keep them, to help keep them here in Maine.
Yeah, and Alex, as I look at this list, one that stands out to me, speaking of birds, is the golden eagle. Tell me about the situation for the golden eagle in Maine.
Yeah, so golden eagles historically nested at a couple of sites in western Maine. But one of the challenges with just changing forest practices, because they need large open spaces to hunt, is that we think that as the state was reforesting and there were some other landscape changes, that golden eagles actually stopped nesting in Maine. There's a couple different reasons for that, but it just seems like it wasn't the best fit for them anymore. So one of my coworkers has been working on a golden eagle tracking project right now, where they're actually looking at birds from further north that are overwintering in Maine. So they actually catch them and they put on these GPS transmitters so we can actually find and track as golden eagles leave Maine and they go up into northern Canada.
And what is the hope there by tracking them? How can you entice them to come back to Maine?
Exactly. They seem so far, I think we're just finished up our second winter of field work, but they seem to want to come back to the same part of Maine where they successfully overwintered before. But really, it's just trying to better understand, you know, we get reports of people seeing these birds, but we just don't know much about them because they look similar enough to a bald eagle. They're very rare, very evasive. So it's just trying to fill in that information gap to look at what tools do we have available to help them, give them a helping hand.
Sure. Over the years, as we've done birding shows on Maine Calling, often people will call in certain that they've seen a bald eagle, and the ornithologist almost always have to disappoint them and say it was probably a young bald eagle, right?
I mean, did I say that wrong? They think they've seen a golden eagle, and what they've really seen is a young bald eagle.
Yep, they can look similar. So my advice is always take a good photo, send us the photo, and we'll do our best to help you identify it.
And Laura, every year we hear about projects, especially in Acadia National Park, where paths might be closed to try to help out the peregrine falcon. Is Acadia the only place in Maine where there are peregrine falcons? Or are there some other places as well?
No, they do. They historically nested on like rock cliff faces, which of course there are some great examples of that in Acadia. So that's part of why we have the experience those closures there. But they do actually nest. They even nest in southern Maine, and really a lot. Oh, they can nest in cities, often on our bridges, actually. So they do nest probably pretty close to where you're sitting right now. There are not a ton of nesting sites, but they are fairly widespread.
Okay. Alex, I know that you really wanted to talk about the Maine Wildlife Action Plan. What is that and what's its purpose?
Yeah, so I think, you know, starting off, waiting till species reach these critically low populations before we try to conserve them, we realize is not always the best way to go. So for the past 2 years, we've been working with Maine Natural Areas Program, Maine Department of Marine Resources, and Maine Audubon, as well as hundreds of other people on the Maine Wildlife Action Plan. And in there, we really identify and do this comprehensive kind of at-risk assessment for species, identify species that might be declining or might, you know, if we don't do something, reach these low populations, and really try to say, here's where we should be focusing our attention so we prevent species from needing to be listed in the first place. So we feel this is being proactive is probably a better strategy than reactive for wildlife.
Can you give me some examples of where Maine and all these organizations together have decided to focus their action and really protect a particular species or group of species?
Yeah, so in the plan, we outline different voluntary conservation actions that anyone from an individual landowner, an organization, or even private landowners, think of working with kind of Maine's forest industry, voluntary actions they can do that might help out some different species. And it's tough. I mean, I think the biggest topic we hear about is sometimes dam removal, you know, and while that can certainly help migratory fish, we have to balance this with the fact that we have invasive fish species too. So removing one dam could actually open up and get and infest more bodies of water with these other species. So, you know, a lot of times it's outlining that we need to, you know, look at this at a maybe dam by dam perspective to look at our conservation efforts, as well as other voluntary actions, such as putting out bird boxes for some of those aerial insectivores that Laura mentioned earlier.
And Laura, what would you like to add to that? What in the Maine Wildlife Action Plan is of greatest importance to you, or what are some of the highlights of what you're really hoping that it will accomplish?
For me, a big part of the, I think a lot of this work really gets done most effectively is by collaborating and having different partners together. And so I guess on a bigger picture, the Wildlife Action Plan, I think, is a great opportunity. I mean, it was a good opportunity for many of us that work in this field to get together and identify our problems and possible solutions. And likewise, I think that I'm looking forward to seeing how different colleagues all get together across organizations and solve some of our problems collaboratively, because that's something I think Mainers do pretty effectively. And I'm looking forward to seeing that happen.
Well, we haven't talked about what's going on in Washington yet, but we need to go to a break. So when we come back, we will talk about what is before Congress, how the Endangered Species Act could be changed. But first, we're going to go to a break, and we want to remind you that you can call and ask a question of our experts. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about threatened and endangered species in Maine, including The New England cottontail, the leatherback turtle, bats, beetles, and butterflies. We're learning about protections for these creatures, and we are about to talk about the proposed federal changes to the Endangered Species Act. My guest today, Dr. Alex Fish, a wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Laura Zitzke, wildlife ecologist with Maine Audubon. Join the conversation. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Laura, okay, now the federal question. How much of a change is being proposed? What kind of impact would it have on the list that we're familiar with, the process that we're familiar with?
Yeah, well, it's pretty complicated. I would like to start off, I think, by just saying that the Endangered Species Act is overall, it's a very beloved piece of law. I think a lot of folks really care about our most vulnerable species. And it has been successful when you think about the whole point is to prevent an animal from going extinct. The Endangered Species Act has been really successful. We have kept 99% of our species that we've listed. So I have to put in that little plug for our Federal Endangered Species Act before I go on. But there have been, it's really, a multi-pronged attack currently on the federal ESA, both kind of from the executive branch, also from the legislative branch, and also even the judicial, really. But some of the biggest challenges right now is the Trump administration is proposing to weaken the Endangered Species Act in really four key areas. It gets a little technical, but one primary challenge is to change the definition of harm. Part of the Endangered Species Act is that people cannot harm these endangered species. And sometimes that can look like harming the habitat which that species needs in order to survive. So, and I'll just make up for example, Atlantic salmon are out on, they're out in the ocean, but then their spawning grounds are completely destroyed, they're not able to reproduce. And so that they would not be able to successfully raise any young. So that is currently included in the current definition of harm, but that is one of the proposal would mean that harm means only immediate injury, which would change really the whole way that the Endangered Species Act works.
Okay. Alex Fish, why? I'm going to ask you sort of the big question here. Why does it matter so much? I'm again looking at the list and I see that something is a snail, the six-whorl vertigo is being threatened. And I'm looking at a beetle, the cobblestone tiger beetle. Why is it important? Why does it need to be law to protect these?
Yeah, it's a good question and it's a tough question, right? I think it, comes down to part of what the department's responsibility, we have laws that we're kind of tasked with preventing these species disappearance and declines. But I think when we think about why do endangered species matter, it's really a deeply personal question. It hits on some of our ethics, and kind of the world that we want to leave for the next generation, that they have these experiences to interact and know that these species exist. But I think one of the other big ways I think of endangered or even threatened species is these are really stewards or ambassadors for things like clean water, healthy ecosystem, and even really think about it, the Mainer kind of way of life here where, we take clean water for granted until it's gone. But yet these species often occur in this aquatic environments or making sure that we're taking care of where they're living and hanging out kind of reflects on our own quality of life. So I think those connections are really important too.
As someone might argue though, and I'll send this to Laura, that, scientists estimate more than 99% of species that have ever lived on Earth have already gone extinct, that this is part of the natural process. Why fight to keep that from happening anymore?
Things do go extinct. That's inevitable. But I think a big thing that I consideration that I always have is why? Is this just a natural cycle, or is this something that we are contributing to? And I think Alex brings up a good point in terms of like the things that a lot of these species need, really, we all need. And so it's pretty important for us. I think that they can be an important, you know, the cliche canary in a coal mine telling us that there is something wrong. We are doing something wrong in some of these areas and need to protect these species that in turn ultimately protects ourselves as well.
We'll go to Martha, who's calling from West Gardner. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm sorry. I'm on a wrong subject, but this is about birds. The whippoorwill. I haven't seen one for years, and I wondered, are they extinct or are they? Am I just not finding them?
Well, you know, I think you're right on topic because, Martha, you're talking about a bird that you love that is hard to find. Alex, is the whippoorwill extinct? Is it threatened? What is the status of the whippoorwill in Maine?
Yes, sir. Whippoorwills are declining in Maine. They are listed as special concern, which for us is kind of our watch list, that if declines continue, they might transition into that endangered or threatened category. We actually have a project going on right now with one of my colleagues where, you know, we're trying to answer some of those basic questions of where are they? Why are they declining? What type of habitats are they using? And we think part of it too is, you know, Maine has been reforesting for the past couple of decades as agricultural lands or what was maybe once pasture is reverting. And so whippoorwills seem to really like those kind of open or fragmented landscapes. And as we're moving to more continuous forest, you know, that might be in part due to it, but we're also concerned about insecticides, declining insect populations, and even just some of the insecticides we're using seem to be bioaccumulating in animals. And we're not really quite sure what that does. Some of these things are pretty new to industry, to science, and we just don't understand them. So there's a lot of questions.
Martha, thank you for your question. And thank you for caring. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Let's see, we're going to go to an email here. This is from Rob. Can your guest describe the benefits of targeting keystone species? Laura, what does Rob mean by keystone species, and why try to preserve that? Why prioritize that?
Yeah, so a keystone species, I mean, he would likely be referring to a species which sort of kind of is the, you know, as the name implies, by protecting a keystone species, it ultimately protects an entire, you know, suite, an ecosystem or a greater ecological spectrum. So, and a lot of our species I think a lot of how you define a keystone species is just how you frame it, because everything is so interconnected. But I think a lot of these endangered species are keystone species, and by protecting them and doing the right thing for them, we ultimately they act like a keystone species and protect a greater suite of other things in the system.
Alex, I know that an oak tree, for example, is considered a keystone species because of how many animals that it either feeds or houses. I'm wondering, in the animal world, what is considered a keystone species?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think I kind of go back to this ambassador standpoint, you know, and I'll say to bring up salt marsh sparrows as kind of a good example. So species that's been declining by 10% per year. Salt marshes might not get a lot of attention by some of the rare plants that they have, but by having this bird there present, that's really telling the story when we can say, you know, salt marsh health is declining. Here's how this species is responding. Here's what it looks like. Show pictures of it. It kind of grabs people's attention and draws them into that story. And then they tend to engage more on threats to that ecosystem or that habitat type. So that's how I think about it. But keystone species, it's such a broad topic that it's really, you're trying to find that thing that resonates with people, that draws in attention and makes people care.
Laura, Alex just mentioned the salt marsh sparrow. I know it was a priority of yours to get to talk about it today. Tell us about this little bird.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, after you asked what species I'm most concerned about, I kind of my head flooded with a variety of things, and I forgot of one of really what should be top of mind, what is typically top of mind for me, which is our salt marsh sparrow. And they are really amazing little birds that I think people don't even necessarily realize are out there and are quite vulnerable because they're one of their most amazing things about them is their nesting cycle is actually synced with our tide cycle. So they raise their young within kind of the high tides of the lunar calendar of them and of the tide cycles. So but as we have increased storm surge and kind of manipulation and deterioration of salt marshes, they've been really they've become more and more declining very quickly, and we are at risk of losing them. So Maine, I'm pretty confident, was actually the first state to actually list them under the state their state in our State Endangered Species Act. And as Alex said, they're not only these, they're I really encourage anyone, if you're out walking the Eastern Trail in Scarborough Marsh, to just, try and notice and look out for these little brown birds that are kind of zipping around and hiding in the grass, and because they're really incredible little birds, but they're hard to see and they're sneaky, but they're really important. They tell us how our salt marshes are doing, which is important for an incredible amount of things, including protecting our own infrastructure. So it's one little species, but they tell a big story. And that's, I think, a great example of what Alex is talking about.
We'll go to Kara calling from Litchfield. Hi, Kara, go ahead.
Hi, thank you, and happy Endangered Species Day. I want to thank the guests, our friends at Maine Audubon. Laura is doing a great job with saving piping plovers on the coast, working with property owners. I have a quick question for Alex. I was thrilled about the inclusion of gray wolves on the State Wildlife Action Plan this year. And a quick question about how you think they might come back to Maine and coyote hunting. What would the impacts of coyote hunting, because they do look so similar to wolves, be on the potential to bring wolves back? Is there anything we can do about that, maybe hunter education or other programs? Thanks.
Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we did include gray wolves, and it's specifically for there's that potential for individuals to come from Canada down into Maine. Obviously, there's an obstacle course along the St. Lawrence Waterway to make that happen. So our really approach is, we want to be part of that early detection. We have that responsibility if they show up to help manage and conserve these species. So a lot of our approach is anytime we get a credible report, we try to show up, get scat samples, tissue sample, even from large coyotes, really trying to look at and build an information library where we can help answer these questions. And while certainly coyote hunting could pose a risk to the species, we don't have evidence of wolves being back here right now. So I think once, if wolves do show up one day, it's going to be an important part of that conversation. But really, right now, we're just trying to gather whatever we can so we have the information to help implement any type of protections that may be needed in the future.
And Kara mentioned that so many coyotes look like wolves, and that is because most coyotes in Maine are part wolf, correct, Alex?
Yeah, so it's really complicated. We like the term Eastern canids because really one of the challenging parts when we talk about wolves or coyotes in the Northeast is we really have to default to the Fish and Wildlife Service and how they define some of these species. There is some evidence out there that says there's part genetic, integration and then how much occurs. And so we really don't have some of those basic understandings or, legal definition of, what is a wolf, what is not a wolf. And so genetics is really complicated. We're learning a lot, and a lot of it depends on what you're comparing to actually look at how similar or different things are. So it's super complicated, and it's something that I have a cursory knowledge and I'm learning more every day.
And I also think Kara's right that the coyotes that are in our neighborhood, or coyotes, some people say, they do not look like Wile E. Coyote from the Bugs Bunny. They are beautiful, fluffy, very wolf-like animals, but not as large as the gray wolves that are in Canada, correct?
Yep, our eastern canids are much smaller. And I'm originally from Minnesota, so I've had some close encounters with gray wolves out there. And even when I see coyotes here, there's a noticeable size difference. So while coyotes are larger in the east than they are in the Great Plains states, there's a lot of factors because generally coyotes here are eating larger prey because they will predate on deer at different times of the year too. Whereas out in the west or kind of Great Plains state, they're much more specializing on small mammals and various small prey sources.
Kara, thanks for your call. We're talking about endangered and threatened species today. It is Endangered Species Day. What are your questions for our biologists? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What's being done to help some of the imperiled creatures in this state? With me today, Laura Zitzke, who is Associate Director with Conservation for Maine Audubon, and Dr. Alex Fish, Wildlife Research Biologist and Population Ecologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Share your comments and questions. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, though, Alex, I want to ask you about the role of trafficking. This is, you know, something that you see on a lot of cable television shows, these stories of really crazy exotic animals being illegally brought into the state, but then also animals that are endangered being captured and sold on a black market. Is that a big problem here in Maine?
Yeah, so while we hear wildlife trafficking, you know, we think of like rhino or like elephant tusks, things like that. One of the unfortunate truths is that we have a couple of turtle species in Maine, the Blandings turtle, the spotted turtle, and then the wood turtle, that there is a huge wildlife trafficking market where people are actually capturing these turtles and then selling them sometimes overseas. And there's been large confiscation events where, you know, we have this problem of, we know these turtles are coming from the wild in some of the northeastern states, and a lot of times they're in poor health, and we have trouble repatriating them and getting them back in the wild. But I think it's important to bring up that, you know, even in Maine, where we think we are very far removed from issues like this, that some of our species here are susceptible to that market. Both all these turtle species have these just incredible turtle patterns or like colors and shapes on their shells, which makes them really attractive. So we even work with Maine Warden Service on how to recognize some of these things. So we always say if people are seeing something suspicious, that doesn't quite seem right, feel free to reach out to us.
And Steve in an email wants to know, what is the status of the Blandings turtle?
Yep. So Blandings turtles are listed under Maine Endangered Species Act, and they have been in Maine for quite a while. And they were recently petitioned for coverage under the federal or the U.S. Endangered Species Act. And so we're waiting on what that determination or decision looks like from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So state level, yes. Federal level is a question mark.
All right. We'll go to Sarah calling from Portland. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this. I am a photographer and an educator. And so one of the things I think a lot about is to protect things, we have to engage with curiosity, right? And create a love and appreciation for them. And I have been lucky enough to get involved now with the Great Blue Heron Project. But it took me a while to figure out a project like that. So I'm wondering, particularly for photographers, what can we do? Are there any forums I might not have thought of? Whereas when we're capturing images of these really incredible creatures, is there something that we can do to be of service in your work that would be helpful to know?
I'll turn to you, Laura. What could, if you're a photographer, a great wildlife photographer, what would be your advice to how Sarah can help?
That's a really wonderful question. And Alex might have some other ideas. I mean, my first My first thought would be sometimes if you get a banded bird, that can be very helpful information. Sometimes you get a picture and you notice its leg might have a little bit of jewelry, so to speak. So a lot of projects will band birds to identify, track movements. So and then bird band, I think, oh gosh, is it birdband.org? Is where I'd have to I'll look up the website to report and get that back to you. But that's one option. I think you've kind of pointed a big opportunity too, in terms of, and I know from working in on a lot of our beach nesting birds, sometimes there's some challenges with photographers getting too close, but it's always also these people that are interested in protecting the birds, and folks that have the right lens can keep their distance and capture amazing pictures. So I think that there's a really good conversation that really could happen about this. And Alex, I don't know if you have, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have a couple of quick thoughts. So first I do want to put a plug in that on the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife website, we do have a participatory or community science page to help connect people to different projects we have ongoing to where you can participate. I think a lot of it is photos are such a powerful communication tool. So I think if there is an opportunity to even share some of your photos with the department, and then we can use that in some of our social media posts or some of our outreach. I think there's potential there. But I think we're grappling in the field of how do we reach more people and how do we integrate some different mediums. And in particular, one project I recently heard of, which I think is super cool, but up in Bangor on one of the pump houses along the Penobscot River, there was a project collaboration between the University of Maine and Bangor Beautiful, where they actually did a mural on the side of the building that was there to kind of help educate people about freshwater mussels and different migratory and native fish in the river there. So if you're in the area, it's something worth checking out. But I think this is a great question, and we're working on it. It's just at a glacial pace sometimes.
And Laura, you found the website.
Yes. Oh, well, there's two options, bandedbirds.org or just one word, bandedbirds.org, or reportband.gov. And again, some of those, sometimes it can just be just somebody taking a picture that can help alert us to species or birds that have been alive and traveling all over the world. It's pretty fun when that works out.
So for if Sarah or somebody else sees a bird with a band, to make note of what time, what date, and what location, how specific would a location need to be?
The more details, the better. I think a lot of our equipment tells us that, like a lot of that information is now just built right into the picture. Thank goodness for those of us that might be not as good at keeping track of those things. But yes, as specific as of a location as you can, is always nice.
All right, great. Sarah, thank you for your question. We'll go to York and Torbert. Hi, Torbert, go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guests. At the local level, there are two things that can be done to create a network in support of these wonderful species. First is that the every t town and city in Maine has got to have a comprehensive plan. And as one of the exercises in it is to have a resource inventory and analysis, which gives a town an opportunity to hire professional biologists to collate all the known information and map out areas where information needs to be developed so that we can note the unfragmented habitat blocks and wildlife corridors and protect and preserve them in our planning process when subdivision review and so on. The other one is every town has a conservation commission, which is a potential nexus for would-be citizen scientists and naturalists to educate themselves and the public about what's available locally and get people out in the field. Because as the gentleman and lady have said, the state is well-meaning and legally sound, but it's just underfunded.
Thanks, Torberts. Alex.
Yeah, so we do have a program called the Beginning with Habitat program that really tries to help package up this information and deliver it to towns, but also to individual landowners. We work really closely with anyone who owns a lot of land, trying to share that information so they know where these rare wildlife resources are, and then where possible they can enact conservation actions as they fit in with their plan. So it's something we've been putting a lot of effort into and in trying to get that communication. But I will note there are some species, because of wildlife trafficking concerns, that we do have to withhold information. And we can't share that as freely as we'd like.
All right. Let's see. We will go to John in Whitefield. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. Well, I was just curious. We've lost our chestnut trees and our elm trees. They're all gone, and whatever they produce for wildlife with them. What about now, where we're facing the prospect of losing all our ash trees and all our beech trees? Do folks on your panel have any sense, or is stuff being studied about that?
Yeah. Laura.
Yeah, it is really sad when we think about, I sometimes think about what our Maine forest, southern Maine in particular, which forest would have looked like during when we would have big chestnut trees. So yes, you're bringing up a real challenge in our field, which is sometimes pests and diseases take out an entire, really an entire species of trees that are dominant and an important food source and of shelter and other things for our wildlife species. But I mean, the silver lining, I guess, that I would offer is if one thing history has shown us is that many species are resilient. So we have lost our magnificent chestnut forests. And yet we do still have, a lot of our species are still there, like whether it's, you know, something common like a gray squirrel or a white-tailed deer or something that's a little more rare. We still have our species, most of our species, and animals do seem to be able to pivot. So losing our ash trees, as it looks like we will happen, is set on a variety of both ecological and cultural levels. But I mean, I think fortunately, we have a lot of smart people working on a variety of approaches, and I think I have to have a hope and faith that our wildlife species will be able to pivot and make do with what happens next.
John, thanks for your call. An email here from Mr. Drew of Mr. Drew and His Animals Too, an animal rescue and rehab organization. He writes, as of 2 years ago, the eastern box turtle was considered Maine's rarest reptile, but was removed from Maine's endangered species list due to the belief that there never really was a well-established population in the state. Being at their northernmost extent of their range, what is to be done should one be found outside? Is it reported? What if someone keeps it, believing it's an escaped pet? Are there fines? It is not on the Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Unrestricted list, so it would require permits to keep, but is technically no longer a native species. And if it is native, why remove it? Please be aware, I do not advocate keeping any turtles as pets, but I deal with these questions on a regular basis, and I would like to know how to answer the public if it arises. Alex.
Yeah, so the caller is right. We did remove that species. Occasionally we come across or observe box turtles, but pretty intensive work went around, and it always seemed like it was a single individual. And if you look at our map on our website, it seems to correlate with major towns, sometimes even college towns. So we thought maybe these were released pets. So I think if, you know, we do get reports of them, please let us know, because we will follow up. And if we learn something new or we do find a population, we will certainly revisit that listing decision that we had. And I unfortunately don't have an answer, or we have to dig into some more information related to keeping in captivity and in the unrestricted list.
All right. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question. Lisa and Gardner, if you could be super quick, that'd be great.
Yeah, technology use and encouraging citizen science, like the Merlin bird ID. I just got home and I sat outside and had 10 species.
Okay. So we have all these apps now, Laura. And she mentioned Merlin. Are these helpful to you at Audubon?
Yeah, absolutely. Merlin is an incredible tool to help us get to know what species are around us. And this is a really wonderful time of year to be in Maine, even on a gray and rainy day like today. We still have species that have been in the tropics coming through. So Merlin is great because also that information goes back to Merlin, so they can kind of track things. It's not foolproof. There are, you might catch some funny things, but I know Alex mentioned it too. It's always great to report via eBird and iNaturalist and other reporting tools. It gives us information so we all can learn more.
Well, thank you both for joining us for the hour. Laura Zitzke is a wildlife ecologist and Associate Director of Conservation with Maine Audubon. Dr. Alex Fish is a wildlife biologist and ornithologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Every Friday afternoon, we create a Maine Calling newsletter. It goes out to tell all of you what's coming up next week and also to share some links. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You can find that at mainecalling.org. Again, mainecalling.org. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.